Ho, 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 let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or a bunch more tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. It's a real privilege and honor to have Bill come back, tell us about his life of sobriety. I see him everywhere. He's always in black. You know it's Bill as soon as you look in his direction, and he's always got that aura about him. I won't go on too much longer. I think a whole lot of his sobriety. I'm glad y'all braved the weather to come out tonight. I know it's Christmas season. I think it's going to be a very special night for everyone. Bill, come up. Take over, will you?
My name is Bill, and I am an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here tonight. It's not the first time I've even told my story here, but it's been quite a while since I've done it before. And I'll begin by saying that there's three stories. There's one, there's a story you plan to tell. Two is a story you told. And three is a story you should have told. And so hopefully I can bring those together and be a little bit more cohesive here about this tonight. I want to begin, like I do often, with a couple of apologies. And one of the apologies is that I did something which I've heard over and over and over in AA is a no-no, something you should not do. And that is I stopped attending meetings for almost a decade. And this happened as a result. I was about 15 years sober at the time, and I moved out to Douglasville. And I came down with night blindness. It means I couldn't drive after dark. The freeway was okay because it was well lit, but once I got off the freeway, I couldn't really see much of anything. And I asked the eye doctor, I said, what's the problem? He said, well, you have cataracts. And I said, well, if I get rid of the cataracts, will that solve my night blindness? He says, I don't know. So I couldn't put the words knife, eye, and cut together in the same sentence and be comfortable with it. So I just let it go. But it meant that I sort of stopped going to a lot of meetings, especially if they're after dark, and I kind of got my habit doing that. I didn't actually leave AA because I had a number of people that I had known in the program. I'm an artist. We had formed a group of artists. It was open to anybody, like any AA group is. And so I had a number of people that I had that dual connection with. They were fellow artists as well as being alcoholics. And I maintained contact with a lot of those people. And one of them was one of my sponsees, and I had contact with him on telephone and in person a good number of times. And also teaching at an art college. Art students are perhaps a little higher percentage than normal of people who get involved with alcohol and drugs. So I had an opportunity to minister to some of these people because the school knew of my history, and I was, and so when they had a student that had a problem, they would send them to me. So I didn't really leave AA, but I didn't attend very many meetings during that time. And then after about 10 years, the board of directors decided to shut down the school I was teaching at. And since the two people I had the greatest affinity for were struggling young artists and struggling young alcoholics, I figured since I'm going to lose that contact with the people at school, but maybe I better get back to AA. So I started coming back to meetings, and that was in 2000, spring, in the January of 2006. And I've been coming back regularly ever since then. I celebrated my 34th year last October. which is a staggering prospect for me. And the idea that when I came in the program to you, told me I'd make it 34 years, I would have said, you know, no way. There's no way I could have done that. When I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not really want to be here. One, I didn't think I was a real alcoholic. And the first thing that I did when I came to my first meeting here at NABA. We used to sit along that wall there. That was a smoking section in those days. And there was a little shelf there, you could a place to put your ashtray. And other than that, the chairs were red, not black at that time. And otherwise, that place was pretty much the same now as it was back then in 1980, which is when I came here for the first time in terms of that. And when I come to meetings at NABA now, I like to sit along that wall kind of as an homage to the beginning, to the early days when I first came into this program. And so I always sit along that wall, even though there's no ashtrays anymore on that table over there. I quit smoking in 1992, and that was one of the hardest things I think I'd ever done. You know, I think it was actually harder for me to quit smoking than it was to quit drinking, because smoking is something that you did every 20 minutes regularly throughout the day, and it was a tough one. But I was able to succeed in doing that. The second apology I want to make is based on my inherent feeling that I never fit in. And increasingly, as I go to meetings, I hear people tell their story. They say, I know this is AA, and I need to apologize. I'm going to be talking about drugs, because drugs are an important part of my story. And I want to apologize because drugs are not an important part of my story. And I feel that that means I don't fit into the current crowd of people out there anymore. My problem was alcohol. It was pretty much. Marijuana had that a little bit when it was popular in the late 60s and early 70s, but whenever I smoked marijuana by myself, I got paranoid. And paranoia was not a turn-on for me. So that never was an incentive. When I moved to Atlanta, which I did in 1971, that was I was in Canada before that when I was drinking. When I was drinking and smoking marijuana, but when I came to Atlanta, I stopped and stopped ever since. So that never was a problem for me. My problem was pure alcoholic. But like I said, I didn't really think I was a real alcoholic when I came in. In fact, I was convinced when I walked in the door. I tried to tell everybody, "Look, I'm not a real alcoholic. Understand that." I'm here because the doctor had said I've got to limit myself to two drinks a day because you've damaged your liver from drinking. It didn't occur to me at the time that maybe non-alcoholics don't damage their liver from drinking, but at that time that I recognized that about myself. And since I've been in the program, I begin to see more and more alcoholic patterns that develop long before I really came to the point of coming to grips with the fact that I was an alcoholic. This is the 22nd of December. This is my daughter's birthday. And it brings to mind something that happened 20 years before I even came into the program. And my first marriage was not a very successful one. I was really kind of unhappy in it. But my wife was pregnant, and she was with my daughter, our daughter at that time. And at that time, the mother and the child had to spend 5 days in the hospital. So I thought, well, this is a chance where I can get out and really whoopee it up. You know, I'll have 5 nights and I can just go, you know, and I don't have to worry about coming home at night, and I can have myself a ball. And then my daughter went and got born on the 22nd of December, and my favorite bar was closed for the Christmas holidays. And so instead of celebrating the birth of my daughter, I was mad because she was born at a time that it robbed me of my ongoing whoopee party that was something that I had in mind. That's pretty alcoholic thinking, I think, at that time. And this happened long before I had developed a dependency on alcohol. I could quit at that time for days, weeks, even months. And I didn't develop the 24/7 kind of drinking pattern that I did toward the end of my drinking at that time. But I look back at that now and I can begin to see that I had alcoholic tendencies long, long before I identified myself as being, in a sense, an alcoholic. Like I say, I resisted coming into the program. I thought the big book was hokey. I thought it was kind of a mixture of pop psychology and Midwestern folk wisdom. You know, I thought it was corny at best, you know, and I read that. You know, and I didn't need all this stuff up here that you people. I was glad there was a place for people like you to go. See, I thought that was something. But I just had to get through the next 6 months because the doctor said I had to limit myself to 2 drinks a day. Well, two drinks a day is like kissing your sister. I mean, it's not something that had any appeal to me whatsoever. 2 drinks a day just did nothing, you know. So I knew I was going to have to quit for that time, but I was just going to quit for that 6 months. And I started coming to AA, and somehow during the course of that 6 months, I met enough people, enough things, so that I began to move slowly, bit by bit, into the realm of recognition that I was just as alcoholic as anybody else was at that time. But it took me a while to do that, and in fact, it took me quite a long time to do that. One of the biggest problems I had was with God. And I had dismissed God from my life when I was 11 years old after the death of my father. My father was a famous politician in Minnesota, which is where I grew up. He'd been a U.S. congressman and lieutenant governor of the state and all that, and he had not spent much time with me, and I knew that I had his name. I was a junior, and I had to live up to the legacy of this man, and I felt woefully unable to do that. And he was the only person who could help me. And he had gotten a different job then, and had just spent 10 days at a cabin that we had in northern Minnesota, a summer cabin. And he looked forward to the fact, he says, I'm going to be able to spend more time with you. And I thought, well, this is finally the man who can tell me I can live up to his legacy. And I remember getting on my hands and knees and thanking God for bringing my father back into my life. And the next morning he was dead. So I thought, well, why would God do this? It must either be because I'm not worthy. And people would say, well, God needs your father. And I thought, well, here's the Lord of the universe, and he needs somebody more than an 11-year-old boy does. And I thought that was a pretty egotistical God. And I just sort of dismissed God pretty much at that time. And when they talked about God at meetings, I was just almost having an anxiety attack. I'd get up and leave the meeting. It wasn't an intellectual thing. It was I'd actually start shaking and trembling. And it took me a while to recognize that that origin of that came back to that death of my father and the time that he had died. And that stopped the anxiety attack, but it didn't change my belief in God at all. That happened sometime later. And at that time, I was my Wednesday night group was my home group. And they had a policy where they would let the person who was having their birthday pick the meeting. And there was a Catholic priest in the program. His name was Father Noel. People who have been around for a while may have remembered him. And I knew he gave a talk on spirituality, so I asked him if he would give that talk at my birthday. And he agreed to do that, and then the word got out, and this room was packed. I mean, the curtain was down. People were sitting on the floor, crowding in the doorways, the biggest crowd I'd ever seen in this room. And I thought, here are a bunch of people, most of whom are not Catholic, coming to listen to a Catholic priest give his talk on spirituality. Something's going on here. You know, there's something being tapped inside people that seems to have a sense of reality in there. Why would something like this happen? A kind of a searching and a longing that was going on. And that helped me in a way toward moving a little bit toward God. But what really helped me in that regard, and I'll talk about a little bit about the steps as I go through and how they manifested themselves in my life. But what really did it was a sense that it tells us in the third step in the 12 and 12 that dependency with a higher power is actually, more independent than we are not being. It's one of the great paradoxes of AA. The more dependent I am on a higher power, the more independent I actually become. So if I'm seeking to become independent, the best way to do that is to become dependent on a higher power. That's kind of a contradiction in terms, or seemed to be a contradiction to me at the time. But it did seem to be sort of a reality. And I found out that they used the analogy in there about our dependence upon electricity. And as I thought about it, I thought, well, if I've got a toaster, and I'm telling myself, No, I'm not. You have to convince me that alphabet, that if I'll give you the wall, is really going to make it work. Or I'm not going to put it in, plug it in the wall. And people say, well, just plug it in. No, no. I got to believe that it's going to work. I got to believe that it's going to help me. It's going to turn me myself before I'm willing to do that. So that's the advice I had. I had to believe in God before I could turn myself and well over to a girl of God. I had it backwards. What happens is that actually, it wasn't an intellectual reasoning that caused me to move against God. An intellectual reasoning wasn't going to bring me back to God. That's not how it happened in my case. What experience did and does. And I found out that if I act as if there is a God, and if I pray, my life gets better. I don't know why, it just does. And it's kind of like my willingness to plug that thing in the wall. I don't even have to understand electricity or even know how it works. I just need to know that if I plug it in, it'll work. And I think that's kind of what happened to me with the idea of God. And the best analogy I heard about that came from a friend of mine in the program who said, to use the analogy of a fitness center. He said, if I go in a fitness center and there's treadmills and there's weights, I don't have to believe in treadmills, I don't have to believe in weights, but if I get on the treadmill and if I work out with the weights, my body's going to get stronger. Belief has nothing to do with it. Action does. And so it's what I do, not what I believe. And so by the action led me to the belief. In other words, the belief followed the action. It didn't precede the action. I found out that when I prayed, when I acted as if there was a God, my life went better. Things were smoother. I didn't have as many anxieties. I seemed to be more efficient in a lot of things that went on and good. And that seemed to be evidence enough for me. You know, and I didn't worry about who that was or doing it. I just know that the process, and that's what I love about AA, it doesn't emphasize who you say it to. It just leaves that up to the individual. It emphasizes the process. It talks about what happened when you have a power greater than yourself. And I fact that, and for a long time I decided that God was a verb rather than a noun. It was what God did that mattered much more than who God was, as far as I was concerned. And went on. And that's how I kind of somehow came around to the belief that there was a higher power. And I stopped worrying about trying to nail him or put God in a box. I just realized that all I have to do is act as if there is a God, and then the reality of that belief sort of brings me about it. I was diagnosed as what they call a visual spatial learner, which means I don't learn things the same way other people do. I don't learn things in sequence, and I don't learn things from books. I look for patterns. I have a kind of a holistic approach to things, and that's how I approach the program with Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I can go through the steps in order and I see the sense of it, but that's not how I sort of learned them. The first three steps I treated as a single package. And this was a package that somebody had suggested to me. And the analogy I use there is if my refrigerator breaks down, the first thing I try to ask myself is, do I know how to fix it? If I do, then I'll fix it. If I don't, then the next question is there anybody out there who can? Yes, call a refrigerator repair person. So I came to believe that there was somebody who could fix the refrigerator, and then the last step is I'll turn it over to them. I'll call them and have them come and do that. I've just taken the first three steps. And I realize I do this in many, many areas of my life. So the only question I need to ask myself is, can I solve my own alcohol problem on my own? If I can't, Alcoholics Anonymous has got a pretty good track record in terms of doing that. I think I'll let them do that. And that's how I took the first three steps initially. And it's sort of built from that standpoint, because Sarah was that way. And some of the patterns, I'll talk about some of the patterns I looked at. That's a pattern for me. That first three steps are a package that goes along like this. Another package that goes on, I've heard it said that AA can be summed up as a phrase, trust God, clean house, and help others. And so for me, 4 and 5 are the way that I clean house, learn how to clean house. 6 and 7 are the way in which I learn how to trust God. 8 and 9 are the way I learn how to help others. And so once I've learned that, then 10 is a practice. 10, 11, and 12 are the practice. 10 is how I practice the cleaning house. 11 is how I practice serving God. And 12 is how I practice helping others. So 10, 11, and 12 are the practice. It's kind of like this is driving the car. 4 through 9 are learning how to taking driving lessons. So when I learn how to do it in 4 through 9, then I can practice it in 10 through 12. And I think that for a long time I looked upon the 10th step as being kind of a mini fourth step. But it says in a paragraph in the 10th step, it says, be on the lookout for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And where did I hear those words? Well, I heard those words when I did the fourth step. And it says, be on the lookout for these. When they occur. It doesn't say if they occur. It says when they occur. Immediately ask God to remove them. Well, that's step 6 and 7. And just talk to somebody about them quickly. And that's step 5. And then it goes on to say, make amends if you've harmed anybody. That's 8 and 9. And then it says, resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you could help. That's step 12. So it recycles 4 through 9 on an ongoing basis, and I find that that's the most useful paragraph that I found in the whole program, because I can always do that. Every time I get irritated, every time I want to tip over the shopping cart or somebody who's got 12 items in a 10-item checkout line, every time I want to take the guy that's driving improperly and drive him into the bridge abutment, you know, then I can go through, I can cycle myself through those things. And it's a good job of me. So that, is again, is another pattern that I developed within there. I have a friend of mine in the program, and he's one of these by-the-book people. He says, if I sponsor somebody, they're going to do things exactly the way the book says they're going to do it this way, or I won't sponsor them. So I tell him, I said, I'll make you a deal. I said, if I get somebody who's willing to do that, I'll turn them over to you. If you get a rebel, if you get somebody coming to the program, and he's argumentative, he doesn't want to do it, he doesn't believe it, let's send him to me. Because I'll demonstrate how the steps have come alive in my life, starting from a standpoint of being a rebel. That the AA program works for anybody, but each person has to find, have to carve their way through the steps in the ways that satisfy them the most within that way. And nobody in AA can tell anybody else what they have to do. I can only talk about my experience. I can't talk about what you should do. And when I do, then it comes very, very close for me to be like playing like God. You know, when I decide that I know better for you than you know for yourself. I can be right about that, but that still doesn't keep me from wanting to play God. And playing God for me is a dangerous thing for me to do, because I have a tendency to think that my wisdom is superior to your wisdom and you'd better listen to me. That's one of the character defects I think that is that I have, and I don't. I try not to engage in that process or that phase that way. I have again at the third step. One of the things it says in the third step in the 12 and 12, it says self-reliance was a bone-crushing juggernaut whose final result was ruin. That goes in the face of everything my family had taught me. When I first came to the program and I talked to the part of my extended family and I said, I'm powerless over there, they said, you're not powerless. What the hell do you mean you're powerless? You've got all the power you want. Drink doesn't pick itself up off the table. You just have to exert willpower. My family worshipped on the ground of self-reliance as the key toward everything. And they said things like, your father would turn over his grave if they heard you talking about powerless. So I had to fight that kind of attitude, which was prevalent out there, that you lift yourself up by your own bootstraps, by God, you know, and everybody has the power and the ability to do that. And so I come into AA, I had to fight that tradition back there in order to reach the point of admitting, you know, in a sense of powerlessness. And I think AA is nothing if it is not full of paradoxes, full of conditions and things like that which seem on the surface to be contradictory but in fact actually turn out to be true. And that's one of the things that I think I discovered after a long, long time here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I first came to the program, I mentioned I came in with a chip on my shoulder. I came in trying to convince people that I wasn't really an alcoholic. And the two gentlemen that met me here when I first came over here on the program said to me, and they were helpful, and I said, well, if I join AA, what do I have to do? And they said, nothing. I said, what do you mean, nothing? And they said, well, there's no requirements in AA. The only requirement is the desire to stop drinking, the membership. And I said, well, what about these steps? And they said, well, many of us feel that the steps not only help us to stay sober, but help us to feel comfortable in our sobriety. And if you want to take the steps, those people here will be glad to help you do that. But it's entirely up to you. You know, that's up to you and what it is that you do. And I can remember an old-timer who was sitting downstairs once, and he was talking to a newcomer who was shaking like a leaf. And the newcomer said, I got to quit. The old-timer looked at me and said, you don't have to quit. Who told you had to quit? You can drink all you want. He said, no, you don't understand. If I don't quit, my wife's probably going to leave me. I'm going to lose my job. The old-timer said, well, you might lose your job anyway. Your wife still might leave you. And I remember I went to him after, and I said, what are you doing? Why are you not being encouraging for this person? He said, he doesn't want to quit. I said, sounds to me like he wants to quit. And he said, no, he wants to keep his wife and keep the job. That's what he wants. And if he could find a way to do that and still drink, he probably would. And he didn't hear that magic word, I want to quit drinking, no matter what. No matter what the consequences are. Tell us no wife or no wife, job or no job, whatever. And I reached a point where I say that I want to quit drinking. Until that happened, and without reservations, chances are pretty good that's not going to be successful for me out there. And that's what this old-timer was doing. And he also told me, he says, never, ever tell a newcomer don't drink no matter what. Because you might be depriving them of the bottom they need to hit in order for them to want to come in here and have the program work. Yeah. If you want to drink, drink. If you don't want to drink, we'll try to help you. Quit drinking. But it has to come from you. It has to come from the bottom up. Which I think is part of one of the brilliant aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous, is it recognizes that nothing's going to work unless it comes from within the person themselves, in their desire, in a sense, to do so. Another pattern that I use, and this is what I call my three legs of my stool of sobriety. It's what do I need, where do I find it, and how do I get it? Well, the first step is, what do I need? It tells me that on page 45 in the big book, where it says in there, it says, we had to find a power greater than ourselves, obviously. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. It enables you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Steps aren't going to solve your problem. Fellowship's not going to solve your problem. Finding power greater than yourself is going to solve your problem. And all those other things are simply steps toward that end, toward that goal. Okay, this is what I need. Where do I find it? Page 55. Because we finally found that the great reality was deep down inside of us. That's the way it was with us. Then. So I say to myself, if that reality is inside me, then it's inside everybody. And that everybody has that thing inside them. Sometimes it's pretty well obscured. Sometimes it's pretty well hidden. Sometimes it's pretty well covered up. But it's always there. And so when I meet people, I try to look for that spark inside people, knowing that I'm not giving them something that they don't have. They already have that power. That power is within us. It's been within us since birth. We have just denied that it was there because we've squandered our life with all kinds of other things out there, notably alcohol. In my case, I could use the promises that we read in here against alcohol. Alcohol did for me what I could not do for myself. I just turned my will and my life over to care of alcohol on many, many occasions. Alcohol was a higher power. It did all the things that happened obviously came true to me in alcohol. One of the speakers of the program talked once about how he's walking into a bar, and the people in the bar would all be looking at him saying, who's this jerk? Who's this guy coming in here? I'd take a couple of drinks and the very same people would be waving at me saying, we love you. And that's kind of what alcohol did for me. It would be hard to give up something, you know, that had that kind of power. I kind of imagine it had me feel like I belonged, had me feel like I fit in. It did not make me fit. That was a pretty hard thing, in a sense, to give up. So AA had to provide for me an answer to that dilemma. And just fear of what's going to happen to me if I go back out there is not going to keep me sober. Because whenever I operate out of fear, the fear was if I go back out there, what's going to happen to me if I start drinking? That fear has a nasty little side effect with it. It's called resentment. After a while, whatever is causing me to feel fearful, I'm going to develop a resentment toward it. You know. And eventually that's going to lead me to the point of saying, I'm really not going to let you produce a fear in me. Fear is a short-term solution. It works very effectively in the short term. Every politician knows he's going to get more votes by making you afraid of what will happen if the opponent wins the election than the positive things will happen if he wins the election. And so therefore, fear will motivate people. So, but it's only for the short haul. And I think that's based upon our survival instinct. It's based upon that flight or fight syndrome that comes when there's a real danger happening out there. And but when we carry that around in our head, when there's no real threat, except what's going on in my head, the ideas of what's going to happen to me tomorrow and so on and so forth, there's no real threat. If there's a saber-toothed tiger loose and coming down the hallway here, then there's a threat. And it makes sense to trigger that flight or fight syndrome. But otherwise, the tigers are running in my head. They're not running out there. So forth. It's my imagination that drives me into that and which makes the fear. Yeah. I didn't recognize fear when I first came into the program because how it disguised itself. One of the great disguises of fear is anger. You get a lot of testosterone points by being mad. You don't get too many by being afraid. So like, so-and-so pisses me off. I hate this person. That's good masculine feeling, but I'm afraid of that person. No, you don't get any points for that. So anger gets to become an adequate substitute for fear because it fits into the myth that we carry on in our heads about the way in which we can carry out. It's only the ineffectiveness of this behavior that ultimately leads us away from them, just like the ineffectiveness of alcohol. I used to think that alcohol caused me to alleviated my feelings and my problems. I don't think it ever did alleviate them. I think what it did is it created the illusion that it was alleviating them. But it was an illusion. It just covered them up. They were still there. And they snuck out in very sneaky ways, you know, that I would hide myself from. I always have to watch and be very careful about this idea of turning my will and my life over to the care of God, because I have an infinite capacity to rationalize what is really my will as God's will. God, is it okay if I hate this guy? Skies open up and the voice comes down and says, you can hate him, Bill. I hate him too because he's an asshole. And I'm convinced that I was responding to God's will. There are people on this planet who feel that they're answering God's will by strapping dynamite themselves and blowing themselves up in peace apart. They're convinced that they're honoring God's will. So I have to be very careful when I think that I'm operating under God's will. And therefore the criteria is, am I operating within the principles that I see outlined in the prayers in the Alcoholics Anonymous? None of the prayers in Alcoholics Anonymous say anything outside of myself is going to change. It doesn't say I'm going to get a job. It doesn't say the girl I love is going to fall in love with me. It doesn't say I'm going to earn a lot of money. It doesn't say any of those things. It says fear of people and economic security will leave us. It doesn't say economic insecurity will leave us. It just says fear of it will leave us. So it's all about what happens inside. And it's full of phrases like, we're amazed before we're halfway through. We'll discover our new attitude or alcohol came without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. And so all of the promises out there are not mentioned at all in the step. They come about as a byproduct, it seems to be, of the things that the steps suggest that I do. And the steps are the process through which I mainly get rid of the stuff that's standing in my way. It's more a reduction process than it is an additive process. The reason I can't feel the sunlight of the Spirit is because I have blockages. I have things that are keeping me from seeing that. I've got to clear that stuff out of the way. And that's what steps 4 through 9 are all about, is mainly cleaning house, is getting that out. That seems to be the essential thing that is done in Jitta. I'm also a believer that there's no such thing as a bad fourth step, because it says in there that this is a first attempt to do that. And no matter how inadequate my step was, once I've opened that door, I can open it again any time I choose, any time I can fix them up. But I don't call it taking the fourth step again, I just call it inventory. Taking a look at what's going on and taking a look at the result of what certain attitudes it is that I have out there. But step 4 opened the door, and step 5 opened the door of recognizing I didn't have any great white light experience when I took step 5. But what I did do at step 5 is I discovered a closeness to another human being in a way that I had never done before. The man who was my sponsor, I did my fifth step with, was as different on the outside from me as two people can possibly be. I'm a liberal artist, college professor type. He was an arch-conservative businessman from Dunwoody. On the surface, we had almost nothing in common with each other. But when I got a couple of notches below the surface, even though he took a different path than I did, I find out we're amazingly alike. And I find that as human beings, if I appeal to people at the levels beneath the things that make us different, I find a commonality. And I'm convinced if I go deep enough inside every human being, I find more commonality than I find differences. Differences are only on the surface. And those are the things we go to war over. Those are the things that we battle each other with. The things that arise from that. Your politics, your religion, your attitudes, things like that. I also discovered about myself that I convinced myself that I drew the conclusions that I did based upon an analysis of the facts. That's not true. I had a predisposition toward a view, and then therefore I would find evidence to support that view and ignore evidence which denied that view and convince myself that I'm just responding, to the outside stimulus out there. When I'm not, I've already made up my mind. And having made up my mind, then I see evidence only. If I think the world sucks, I can find a lot of evidence out there to support that view. If I think the world is a beautiful place, I can find evidence to support that, too. It's like the world is infinite. It will support any hypothesis I put on it. So I have to be careful of the attitudes I have as I go into something out there, because that's what I'm going to get reinforced. If I'm a Democrat or a Republican, I'm going to see things through the bias of that particular thing. And the more I do it, the stronger my view gets. And the stronger my view gets, the more intolerant I become of people who don't hold that view. So it's very important to me that I not engage in dialogue with people about the things that separate us and differentiate us, and keep my dialogue between the things where we have things in common. That's part of the beauties of AA, is we don't come in here on the basis of the things that make us different. We come in here on the basis of a common problem that we have. And I've never heard a political argument or a religious argument happen in an AA meeting. And I think that gives me a pattern for the way in which if I continue to act as I do in an AA meeting toward people, anybody I meet out there, I avoid a lot of those problems that come about out there. All this is I have learned here in this program. And I have learned it just through the experience of behavior. There's a chapter in the book that says into action. There's no chapter that says into thinking or into feeling. There's a chapter on into action. This is about what I do, not what I think and what I feel. I thought, well, I can't pray until I really believe that prayer is effective. And I found out that that's not true. The effectiveness of the prayer comes about through the action of that. There's a story at the very end of the Igbokor talks. This woman says, if you want to be rid of a resentment of somebody, pray that they have get everything that you want for yourself, for them. He says, even if you don't believe it, in just words, do it anyway. I thought, well, I don't have to have the belief first before I engage in the action. I just have to engage in, I don't have to understand how electricity works to make my toaster work. All I have to do is plug it in. And if I want to understand how electricity works, I can study that, but I don't need that understanding in order for it to work. I don't need to understand who God is in order for it to work. And in my case, I try not to put God in a box because I want to be able to recognize God everywhere. I don't want to be able to say only God, I can only find God here. I think I can find God everywhere if I look. And especially if I know that it exists inside every human being that I meet. Not easy to find sometimes. Just as in my case, I had it covered up with a lot of self-will, self-aggrandizement, and all kinds of things where I felt that I knew better, that self-reliance. When it talks about self-reliance being a bone-crushing juggernaut, it says this is what normal people get. You know, we're practicing alcoholics or not, but we're practicing self-will. And coming to grips with that can only come about when I begin to recognize that it always, always fails. Any prayer that I give that wants something outside to change, say, God, make it not rain today, and then it doesn't rain, I say, oh, God, listen to my prayer. God, you know, make sure that this trip is safe. The trip is safe, but I think God did it. But eventually, it's going to happen. I'm going to get a no answer. And then I'm going to get disappointed. And if I get disappointed enough, then my faith in God is going to go. If it lies upon external saving. But if it lies on what happens in here, then I'm never disappointed. It never goes. Another thing I learned in the program, and then I'll kind of begin to wrap it up here, was when I had about 3 months in the program, I hadn't read the big book, I hadn't done much in the way of the program. One guy here at NABBA, who was the self-appointed mentor, grabbed me one day and he says, come on, you're going to lead a discussion at this treatment facility on Juniper. And I said, no, I'm not. He says, yes, you are. He dragged me out and went down and I got before these people and I fumbled and I stumbled and I didn't know what to say. And afterwards, I looked at the guy and said, you know, you did these people a disservice. You should have had somebody come down here that knew what he was talking about the program. And he said to me something very strange, which I didn't appreciate at the time, which I came later to be. He said that nothing you say is going to either get them drunk or get them sober. I said, well, why in the world do we do it then? He said, because this is not, it's not what you say, it's who you are that matters. These people have been lectured to all their lives by people telling them what they should do. Their parents, teachers, judges, counselors, all kinds of people full of advice on what it is that they should do out there. And all of a sudden somebody comes in and says, I'm just like you. I'm struggling with the same thing you're struggling with. And let's help each other in a sense to do that. And that's where to get sober. And they learn that this is not a getting program. This is a giving program. And the sooner they recognize it, the sooner they're likely to get sober. It tells us that very, very early. And Bill Wilson's story talks about how he was overcome by feelings of despair and resentment. And this is a page after he had that white light experience. He says, nearly drove him back to drink. And he said, it was amazing. He lifted up by going to the hospital and talking to a fellow alcoholic. That's the one thing that works in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there's no easier way for me to get outside of myself than to try to reach out to another person. As a young man, he's still a good friend of mine, my very first sponsee 33 years ago. And he had showed the monumental lack of judgment by asking me to be a sponsor after 9 months in the program. And I found that once I agreed to do that and I read the literature, it's like they changed it. When I was looking at it to see something I could use to help myself, that was one thing, but when I looked at it to see how I could help somebody else, that it worked much, much better than that. Well, I'm going to conclude here with a poem, only poem I've ever written in my life. And it's based upon a natural phenomenon which is called the hydrologic cycle. I remember being impressed with that. The water in the ocean is toxic. You can't drink it directly. But through the miracle of evaporation, it leaves the toxic stuff behind, and then it rains and nourishes the plants and animals through the rain. And there's an Indian saying that goes, a drop of water must rain five times before it returns to the sea. So using that as a metaphor, I wrote this poem. It's the only poem I've ever written in my life, and I conclude that I speak with that poem now. There's a shadow in my memory from the light of a different sun. It has been there since before time, as I knew it had begun. When I try to visualize it, all my efforts are in vain. It's measured in the solitude of the ocean and the rain. Maybe I was all alone on that distant star, and there never was another that went with me that far. There are only fragments of a love I once did touch, just an imaginary playmate that a child loved so much. But those fragments in my memory are just pieces of my night. It's hard to tell for certain if the vision's wrong or right. It is service in my solitude, an image to explain a message that is hidden in the ocean and the rain. I think I tried to find you in coffee shops and bars and supermarket parking lots, on streets and schools and cars. I did not even know who it was I'd come to find, for on the altar of my reason, you had never come to mind. For beauty can't be measured on the surface of the skin or even by the circumstance one happens to be in. Come from other sources, other times, and other places. Can't be seen by anything my conscious mind embraces. But I did not accept this, its message too obscure. I wanted something tangible, I wanted something sure. And all the bright lights glistening with their clarity of sight seemed so much more persuasive than those pieces of my night. And each time I thought it was so sure, the pain was gone. A thousand angry drums drowned out the softness of my dawn. And after all those armies finished marching to the sun, I felt a vacant, empty fog with nowhere left to run. But maybe, just maybe, those pieces that I own belong to another, and I am not alone. And somewhere in the wilderness, those pieces of my night are the heartbeats of another that once I held so tight. Maybe, just maybe, there are pieces in your night that never were forgotten or completely out of sight. And maybe we'll remember that the loneliness and pain served only to remind us of the ocean and the rain. Sometimes I think I'm part of you and you're a part of me, and that we never met or grew up separately. But my reason can't be trusted, and my feelings can deceive me. It is only in surrender that the ocean can receive me. No beauty can't be measured on the surface of the skin, or even by the circumstance one happens to be in. The ocean gathers everyone. It picks up every clue. And the rain falls down. Amen. As you I love, it is you. Thank you.
Merry Christmas, everyone. Tinsley, can you help us offer the gift of sobriety here?
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks, Bill, for that powerful message, which I need to hear because I've got a powerful disease, alcoholism. Anyway, here at this meeting, we offer a white chip for anybody who would like to come to this way of life and try this way of life one day at a time. Anybody like a white chip? Stop.
If you want